Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, September 2nd, 2018. This is episode 1520. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And by Qualcomm Snapdragon. According to Ookla, Android smartphones with Snapdragon 845 from Qualcomm had faster data speeds on AT&T and T-Mobile than non-Android phones with Intel modems, based on over a million real-world tests done in Q2 2018. See all the data for yourself at qualcomm.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about, well, you know, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We've got smartphones. We've got smart watches. By the way, new Apple Watch. Rumor is new Apple Watch. I forgot to mention that yesterday when I was talking about the Apple rumors. New Apple Watch supposed to come out this month, too. The Series 4. Talk about that. I'm a big Apple Watch fan. Actually, I wasn't at first. I was very skeptical about the Apple Watch at first. I didn't think much of it. It just, you know why? It didn't do anything I needed it to do. It's a little bit ugly. It's a little bit expensive. It's a little bit uncomfortable. And I don't need it. That's kind of not the best recommendation for any consumer electronics device. But that was the first edition. Actually, Series 0, we call it. And Apple improved it incrementally, a little bit at a time, added features. And at this point, I wear my Apple Watch every day. I've become an Apple Watch fan, which is kind of interesting. I have other smartwatches like the Samsung Gear S3. It's nice. I don't wear it every day. Fitbits galore. I even wear a fitness ring now that measures my steps and my sleep patterns and all that stuff. I'll talk about it. I can't talk about it yet. I'll talk about it maybe in a month. I mean, not embargoed exactly, but they asked me to wait to talk about it later this month. So I'll have a review of this unnamed secret fitness ring. But even though I'm wearing that, I still wear the Apple Watch. I'm, as you know, going on vacation. The Apple Watch is great for navigation, especially walking navigation. If you use Apple Maps on your iPhone and say, you know, I want to go to the Tower of London. Actually, this is a real world example. By foot, the Apple Watch will then tell you, turn left here, turn right here. It'll buzz on your wrist. And so you don't have to sit there. You know, I hate that, walking along, staring at your phone, trying to figure out where you are and where to go next. The watch does it for you in a very nice way. I like the fitness features. It keeps track of my activities, you know, and it's a good incentive to always close your rings. That's what they do. They have these rings. It's interesting. Google has now added that to Google Fit. The rings made sense, I guess. And so you have three rings on an Apple Watch. There's only two rings, I think, on a Google Fit app. But on the Apple Watch, there's three rings. One for standing, which is so dopey. You're supposed to stand up once an hour. I don't pay any attention to that. One for, what is it, calorie? Now you see, I don't remember. I know there's three rings, and I know I try to complete them. I don't even know what they're for. I think one's for moving, keeping moving, and one's for calories, something like that. But the idea is if you get enough exercise every day, those rings will close. You get little dopey awards. I don't know. I know it's silly. It sounds stupid when I say it out loud, but it works. It incentivizes. It's good. I'll tell you the big thing I use the Apple Watch for. Besides a watch, it is not a great watch even to this day, because to save battery life, when you're not looking at it, it goes dark. It's blank. So most of the time, the Apple Watch is blank, and in order to see it, you have to kind of turn it just right on your wrist, and then it lights up. So I do use it as a watch, but if you're not, you know, upright, it isn't a very good watch. And I have the face I use has day and date, and I use that. I like that. come to think of it, it isn't a very good watch. I use a program on it, though, that lets me record thoughts, keep track of things I've agreed to do, You know, the problem with to-do lists, right, is you always think of stuff you have to do when you're not near a to-do list, like you're driving around. Oh, I really need to clean the garage as you're driving around. You can't do anything about it. Having something that you can just tap and say, remind me to clean the garage, is great. When I leave the dentist and they say, okay, you got an appointment next week, don't forget, I can actually tell my watch. I press a button on my watch. I use a program to do this called Drafts, but there are a number of programs that'll do it. I tap a button on my watch and I say, dentist appointment, Thursday, 8 p.m. No, it's not 8 p.m. It's 8 a.m. And I can even say that. And then later when I get to an iPhone or an iPad, I can actually add that to my calendar. That's handy. And maybe I've just gotten used to the idea of having this giant metal pill on my wrist. But for whatever reason, I like the Apple Watch. I'm excited there is going to be a new one. Although this another argument against the Apple Watch is that it's not really upgradable. When they come out with a new one, you have to buy it. You can't really, you could keep using your Apple Watch, and many people still use their Series 0 or Series 1 from a couple of years back. It's, they get the new software and everything. But if you want new hardware, I mean, it's, you got, I mean, and how many times do you upgrade your regular wristwatch? Never. Maybe you buy a fancy new one to show how much money you got, but silly to have an upgradable watch. That's a silly idea. But of course, it's Apple, so I'm all in. I fell for it. I got the Apple Watch. New one's coming up. I was going to actually talk about self-driving cars. Maybe I'll save that for later in the show, because we've been following this crazy Elon Musk drama. Have you been following this? And I am a Tesla owner. I love electric cars now that I'm a Tesla owner. I love the idea that I haven't been to a gas. Last time I was at a gas station, I was to put air in my tires. I haven't been to a gas station for gas in 2 years. And I have solar panels, so the car is actually just, you know, I'm making the electricity to charge the car right there. It makes me feel good. I like that. I always have a full tank in the morning. Just plug it in when I go to bed. Kind of like my watch. The self-driving features I don't completely trust, but that's okay. You shouldn't. Tesla shouldn't call that an autopilot. It isn't. That implies that it'll drive itself. But boy, they're smart. They are good marketers, because now they offer a Model 3. Basically, I have a Model X, which has basically the same driving self-driving features. You know, it has a smart cruise control, so it'll keep its distance from the car in front of it, follow up to the speed limit that you set. And if the car stops, your car will stop. If it goes again, your car will go again. It also keeps in the lane. That's really more autopilot, right? It knows where the lanes are and it'll keep in the lane. So you really don't have to keep your hands on the wheel. If you flick the turn signal, cameras will look, see if there's a car in the next lane. It'll make the lane change for you. Those are nice features. Tesla lately has really been adamant about keep your hands on the wheel, because there have been some very high-profile crashes. So I don't trust this self-driving thing, but you have to admire Tesla's chutzpah, Elon Musk's chutzpah, because they're offering the Model 3. And they say when you're ordering it, for $3,000 more, we will upgrade your car to self-driving. When, they don't say and if, but they should, and if that's available. And then they say, if you don't order it before now, it'll be $5,000 after. So effectively, they're saying pay $3,000 for something you may get maybe someday down the road. But I should warn you, if you don't buy it now, it could cost $2,000 more. I'm looking at a Model 3 for next year. I don't know. What do you think? It kind of feels like you're a sucker if you do that, doesn't it? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm going to go to the phones in just a minute. You can tell me I'm a sucker. I haven't done it yet. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We are going to the phones. Let's go to the phones. And our first call of the day comes to us from Anaheim, California. Charity is on the line. Hi, Charity.
Hi, Leo.
Thank you so much for calling.
Certainly. I need your help on something.
Yes.
I have an Android, and with my Google program, I have the maps But so I touched something on my screen, and my map is now just a blue dot without any of the words or anything else, and I can't bring my map vision back on.
What?
Just the navigation blue dots there where I am.
What?
Yeah.
So let me look at this again. Now, that's weird. So maps, and you know, one of the things you could do is put some other maps on there and see if those work. Because one of the things that could have gone wrong is maybe your GPS is disabled or location service. But
so how would I find a new service?
But I got to understand what you're seeing. So you launch Google Maps on your Android device.
Okay, my Android has everything on the screen, and it's supposed to be where you touch it, and it goes straight to it. So when I touch the part that says the Google Map,
yeah. It
goes to the Google Map, but all it has is northwest and some kind of longitude and latitude down in the bottom. And then on the top, it just has your blue dot in your screen.
And no map at all?
Right.
Not even like a street or anything?
Correct.
Okay. So a couple of things, you know, we can talk about. One is, I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but let's talk about the controls in the Google Maps. There is a layers control in the right-hand corner. It looks like, do you see a search here box or anything like that? Do you see explore, driving? You just see, I wonder if it's broken at this point.
No, it wasn't supposed to be.
You don't see, well, no, but we can, this is a computer. It can break at the drop of a hat. So, just supposed to be, no, but it certainly could be. But I'm just trying to see, so you see a blue dot, that's your location.
Okay, when I first come on, I do my security thing, then it says select Wi-Fi. So I have a whole bunch of servers. So then when I go on to where it shows my whole icons, it has the Google Maps signal. So then when I tap that,
okay.
It goes to the Google Maps.
What kind of phone are you using?
It's a ZTE Android.
Android phone. Okay. And it has GPS in it?
Yes.
Okay. So that's the first thing you do is go into your settings and make sure location is turned on. Because without location, a map isn't going to work. It needs its GPS. You want Wi-Fi if possible, but you don't have to have Wi-Fi for location. You do need GPS for sure. So on an Android device...
How do I go in to get my GPS for certain?
Well, I'm wondering a couple of things. You've got to have GPS. You've got to have data. It would be nice to have data via Wi-Fi, but you don't have to.
Wi-Fi, data, and location.
And that's all turned on?
Yes.
Okay. So that's good. one way to see if there's something going on with those services is to download another mapping app. Take a look at, this is also from Google, it's called Waze, W-A-Z-E. People use it for routing because it's aware of traffic conditions, but it would just be a way to prove that your GPS is working.
W-A-Z-E.
W-A-Z-E.
Okay.
And download that from the Google Store, the Play Store, and see if that works. If that works, good. That means your GPS is working, your data is working, you've got everything you need for a working Maps app. And then I would say it probably means that the Maps app itself is bad, which means it's an easy thing to fix. You uninstall it and you reinstall it.
How do you uninstall it?
So, a couple of ways to do it. The easiest way is to drag it to the top of the screen. So you're looking at your screen, and now I don't know if your particular phone has a modified version of Android or not, but on most versions of Android, if you drag it to the top of the screen, you'll see a trash can and the words uninstall, and you just put it over there till it turns red and let go, and that will uninstall it. If that doesn't work, you can go into settings, and there's an apps section in settings that you can look at all the apps you have and then delete the ones that you no longer want.
So how do I do that?
So step one would be drag the icon to the top of the screen. If you see a word uninstall, drag it on top of that. It will uninstall it. If that does not work, go to settings. And that you do. You know how to get to settings, I think, because you said
yes.
You were. Yeah. Go into the settings. There's an apps section in the settings. It lists all your apps.
Yes.
And then you can go there and uninstall it from that directly as well. So you just click on the app and there'll be an uninstall button. And uninstalling and then reinstalling will probably, if there's something gone wrong with it, we'll probably fix it. Now, somebody in the chat room has found a link to guidingtech.com that says, fix blank Google Maps. So maybe this is not, let me go look at that link, because maybe what's happening to you is not unusual.
It's not new, because some other people said they put a blue dot issue.
Blue dot issue.
But it didn't help me.
It does say a weak internet connection and an unknown place. So,
yes, I have that problem. So how do I get a better connection?
Well, that's another matter entirely. You need two things. You need a location capabilities, which could be just the Wi-Fi, but generally most Android phones have GPS built in. Mm-hmm. You need that turned on. And then to get a map, if you just have a blue dot and no map, that's because it can't download the map. It does say, by the way, you said at the bottom you see longitude and latitude. Is that correct?
Yes.
Oh, so you do have location.
Oh,
so,
yes, I
so
have
it is just, it's a data issue. It's a data issue. All right. So now that means you're not getting the data, which is the map information. And you who's your carrier? Do you have a cell phone company?
Yes, I do. I'm with
That's all right. That they should be providing you with data. Do you have a plan that includes data?
Yes.
Okay. When you look at the phone, do you see bars, more than one or two bars on there? Do you see the word LTE on the top of the phone there? That indicates your signal strength, and LTE would say you're getting LTE data.
LTE. Well, here it says, cannot update map.
Oh. Yeah, that's because you're not getting data.
Oh.
So, is this a new phone, or have you had this for a while?
No, I've had it for a while.
And it's worked in the past?
My other one burned out, and I sent it to the warehouse, and they sent me this one back. And this is supposed to be a new phone that
to replace it. Maps has never worked on this. This is a brand new phone.
The map was working on it, and then something was touched on it, and the whole image went, and it just went to blue dot.
Okay. So you need, it sounds like, having gone through this now, all this diagnostic stuff, it sounds like there is an issue with data. Data is how it gets the maps. You might try, if you have Wi-Fi somewhere, go to a Starbucks or go home if you have Wi-Fi at home, make sure Wi-Fi's on and see if you get maps. If you do, then you got to check with your cellular company to see why you're not getting data on your phone. You need data to download the maps. Otherwise, you're going to get exactly what you get, which is a blue dot, no map, and longitude and latitude. If that's accurate, then you are getting GPS. You're just not getting the maps. Needs data for those. I think that's it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I think we should take some calls. What do you say? Enough of me blathering. Let's go on to line 3. Jim in Orange County. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for calling.
Great, great. I have got my 95-year-old dad on my cell phone account, and I'm moving it over to T-Mobile, and I want to move him, but he has a flip phone. I need to put a SIM card in his flip phone, but it doesn't have a SIM card.
Yeah, he's got a really old flip phone. Yeah,
I'm looking for another flip phone, because that's what he wants.
Yep.
That will take a SIM card.
Most modern ones will. What I would do is go to a T-Mobile store, because they'll probably give it to you for free.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay, I will do that.
Yeah, because you know why? Nobody wants a flip phone. Except your dad. So they've got a whole bunch of them.
Okay, that's a great idea. Yeah. I'll go over to them.
That way they can verify that it'll work with T-Mobile, that you can use the T-Mobile SIM. And and honestly, they really shouldn't charge you for a flip phone. They want to keep you as a customer. They make more money off of you each month than that flip phone's worth.
You bet. Okay. We appreciate that.
My
Thank
pleasure.
You so much.
Thanks for the call. Kevin in Malibu, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Petaluma.
Hello, Malibu. How's the weather?
Hot.
I don't even want to.
Getting hotter, brother.
Getting hot. It's getting hot in here, but you got the ocean. You can just rip your clothes off and jump in the waves.
I can.
Is the ocean cold in Malibu?
It's always cold.
Yeah.
It was 117 here last week. Malibu was 104.
Yeah.
It's still cold.
And the ocean's still cold. See, I grew up on the East Coast, and they get the Gulf Stream, the Gulf Current coming up from the south, and so the water on the beaches in Massachusetts is warm. And then I got here in California, I thought, sunny Cal. Man, all the surfers, it probably is beautiful. And it's freezing cold.
Yeah, that's why you see them all wearing those wetsuits.
Well, yeah, I guess you go far enough. So I go down to San Diego, it's a little warmer. But, I'm disappointed. I was hoping to move to Malibu to be your neighbor, but I guess not.
It would still be the right move.
Yeah, I know. I bet it's beautiful. I'm jealous. What can I do for you?
Leo, iTunes is not playing fair with me.
Oh, you and everybody else.
Well, let me check this. I'm on a Toshiba satellite.
Yeah.
Windows 10 Pro.
Yep.
iTunes will not open.
It won't even open.
Won't even open.
Well, it should open.
I agree.
When it opens, it may not behave well, but it should open.
No, I know enough to be dangerous, but you know more. I'm looking for a solution. I'm looking for a reason. What do you think, brother?
Well, this is not unusual. Sometimes apps, you'll double-click them. Sometimes they'll go, sometimes nothing. But it's not unusual. Something's wrong. Dare I say, I'm assuming, Kevin, because you're a very smart fellow, that you have already gone to programs and features and uninstalled iTunes and reinstalled it, right?
Well, that was the solution coming up. I called you first, Leo.
Oh, yeah, do that.
So let me ask you this.
Yeah.
If I uninstall the program, the current folder that has my music in it.
No, it won't go away.
Okay, so I can just install it over it.
Well, I would uninstall first. What's probably happened is there's a damaged DLL. These are additional files.
Damn DLLs.
They hate DLLs. They stand for Dynamic Linked Libraries. And what they are is additional support files for the main program. If one of them's broken, or, and this is very common on, so common on Windows, we have a name for it. It's DLL Hell. You've got a similarly named DLL that something else installed, and iTunes goes, well, I'm going to go get the file open routine from a DLL, and it gets the wrong thing, or it gets something it doesn't understand, or it doesn't work at all. And then iTunes just says, I don't know what to do. And it just stops. So the only way to really fix that is uninstall first. I mean, you could try. I mean,
No. We're on the same page. That was my next move. I just thought I'd check. Yeah,
uninstall, reinstall.
You're available.
It will probably replace all the DLL. Well, I wanted to get the weather report from Malibu, too.
Let me ask you something.
Yes,
on
sir.
Your Windows Weekly podcast, your buddy Paul always disses iTunes big time.
Yeah, we but all do. On the Mac Break Weekly podcast, we diss it, too.
So what is the reason that Paul disses it?
Well, that's actually a really great question. You would think, given the importance of the iPhone before that, the iPod to the Apple ecosystem, that Apple would pay a lot of attention to the program that runs on the computer that supports those devices. You use iTunes to back up your iPhone locally. You use iTunes to put music on your iPhone. You can even put applications on your iPhone from iTunes. It's pretty important. Notice that instead of making iTunes work better, what Apple's decided to do is disconnect the iPhone from iTunes, and at this point, you no longer need iTunes at all for the iPhone. That was, to me, a little sign that Apple does not like iTunes that much. iTunes was originally written very fast, especially on Windows. Steve Jobs said, we will never make iTunes for Windows. Fortunately, somebody at Apple said, Steve, you're selling more iPods, many more iPods to people who use Windows than you are to Mac users. So he said, oh, all right. But you write it. I don't want to look at it. So whoever wrote iTunes for Windows probably was a redheaded stepchild to begin with. And I'm sure that the iTunes for Windows group is not perhaps as well funded as even the iTunes for Mac group, which is underfunded compared to the iPhone group. For whatever reason, it was always bad. They took software. They actually bought the software. The basis of it was an audio player that was big on the Macintosh. I think it was Jam many years ago. They bought that, modified it, added a bunch of Apple scripts. For a long time, iTunes was basically Apple script, which is a terrible idea. And over time, I think what's happened is it's just they jammed so much stuff into it that it just doesn't. It's hard to use. Features disappear routinely from it. Go ahead and plug your iPhone in and see what happens. See if you could figure out how to see the iPhone interface. It ain't obvious. It's a little teeny weeny icon.
Every time they do an upgrade, it's like, what?
What? Where did you put
it? Go?
What? Oh, the sidebar's back now. Oh. So, yeah, I know it's a mess. And everybody, not just Paul Theriot, not just Windows users, but everybody from the Apple side as well, the Mac side as well, has said, please, Apple, when are you going to fix this? Why haven't you rewritten iTunes? And I think now it's clear that Apple will never rewrite iTunes, that they're just going to let it fade off into the sunset.
Or do you have an alternative?
On Windows, yeah, there are lots of good alternatives. Here's the nice thing is that at least the iTunes index file formats and syncing and all of that stuff is well understood. So there are a number of players that can be used to play iTunes playlists, to play iTunes music, even to sync to your iPhone. For instance, doubletwist.com is a very nice choice. It's for Android as well as Windows and Mac. I'm a big fan of DoubleTwist. There's a million of them, and almost all of them now support iTunes playlists and formats.
One step further, what is your Linux Mint call for?
For Linux, that's another problem. One more I'll mention for Windows, which is Media Monkey, which I've always liked a lot. It is really smart. It will also sync to your iPhone. For Linux, that's an interesting question. There are some, there was Songbird, but I don't know how well supported it is. There were many attempts to duplicate iTunes on Linux, and none of them have really taken hold.
I've never found one.
I don't know. This is one for the one for the masses.
Well, okay, masses. Leo, thank you so much.
Have fun in Malibu. Go surf.
Surf's up, brother.
Take care, Leo Laporte. The Tech Guy, more of your calls, 888-ASK-LEO coming up. Don't forget the website, techguylabs.com. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage and the folks at Quicken Loans. Quicken Loans, number one lender in the country. Number one in volume, yeah. And that's only since December. And I think that's because for the last 8 years running, they've been number one in customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. Pay attention to your... I just love this. Businesses... So few do this, and it's so important. Pay attention to your customers. Serve your customers. They will serve you. And Quicken Loans does exactly that. That's why they invented Rocket Mortgage. They knew people like us did not want to get a home loan by going to a bank, filling out long applications, going to the attic to get old bank statements, calling the employers from 10 years ago to say, can I get pay stubs? That's not fun. No one wants to do that. Most of the other lenders, that's what they make you do, not Quicken Loans, not Rocket Mortgage. You can do the entire thing online, on your phone even. It's fast. It's easy. They do the work, so you don't have to. That's how it ought to be, right? That's how they get your business. Quicken Loans calls it the power buying process. So here's how it works. You put Rocket Mortgage on your phone, or you go to rocketmortgage.com/tech guy. You answer a few simple questions. First, you have to create an account. In fact, do that now. That'll speed everything up. Once you have the account, then when you say, we're going to go house hunting. Honey, let's go house hunting. Okay, but let me do this first, rocketmortgage.com/tech guy. You answer a couple of questions. They go out with your permission to their financial partners. They say, they verify your income, your assets, and your credit. And then they give you the loan off, options which you qualify. Simple, right? You choose the term, the rate, the down payment, and that's it. You're approved. That's literally minutes. You can do that in an open house. The next step is verified approval. And for that, they're going to be lending you a lot of money. The loan officer goes out and checks, but they don't take their time. They do this all within 24 hours. But within a day, they'll verify income, assets, and credit and give you something they call verified approval. Once you have that, it's as good as cash. You get the letter. You show the seller verified approval. We got the loan. You're like a cash buyer. You go right to the front of the line. I know this from experience, having bought a few homes over my many years, that if you go in there saying, we're going to get the loan. We want this house. Let's make an offer contingent on the loan. Okay, that's fine. A seller will say, okay. But if there's somebody there, you maybe, with verified approval, you go right to the front. They go, oh, well, they've got the loan. Sorry about that contingency thing, but I'm going to sell it to these guys. That's important. It's also important to you for one more reason. They call it rate shield approval. And this is only something that's come up in the last couple of years as interest rates have started to go, actually, not even that, maybe last 1 year. The Fed started raising interest rates, and they said more interest rates rises are coming. And that, of course, immediately affects home loan rates. So they've been ticking up. That's something new. We didn't have to worry about that a couple of years ago. We'd have to worry about it now. And it really is a worry if you're buying a house because there's pressure to buy now. You wait a week, who knows? Could cost you, you know, tens of thousands of dollars more because the interest rates ratcheted up. That's no fun, is it? And you don't want to be pressured to buying a house. You want, you know, oh, we got to buy this. You want to get the right house. You want to have that luxury to say, no, it's not right. Let's look for another one. We did that. It takes a while to find that exactly the right house. So with this rate shield approval, I love this. Rocket Mortgage locks your rate for up to 3 months, up to 90 days while you shop. They say, you know, the rate, you know, that's the rate. It's guaranteed. If rates go down, they'll lower it. But if rates go up, nothing. You know, it stops. It's locked. You win either way. Rate shield approval. This is awesome. It takes all of the nervous making out of buying a new home. You really want to have the luxury to shop for 3 months and find the right place. It's exactly what you'd expect from a company that keeps getting number one in customer satisfaction. They pay attention to how you feel, what works for you, and it works for them because it works for you. How complicated is it? That's obvious, right? All right, I've got to give you a little legalese, you know, as you would expect. Rate shield approval only valid in certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, that's important. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Here's all you have to remember. RocketMortgage.com/tech guy. RocketMortgage.com/tech guy. They win, you win, we win when you go there. Thank you for doing that. I appreciate your support. RocketMortgage.com/tech guy. Now back to the show. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones. Bob, Clearwater, Florida. Thanks for hanging on, Bob.
Hey, hello, DeLeo. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I have an older Lenovo S10. One of those little netbooks that's slowly going bad.
Uh-oh.
So I've been checking around. I haven't decided yet whether I'm going to buy a Chromebook or a regular laptop. But there's I've always bought a regular hard drive in the past. But I was looking maybe in the solid state, and I'm a little bit confused with a couple of terms here.
Sure.
One is eMMC.
Yep.
Compared to an SSD. Now, SSD, I assume, is solid-state drive. What is this eMMC? It's kind of been implied on the Internet that it's a cheaper drive. Is that right?
Both of them are fairly generic terms for a flash memory, non-moving part drive. eMMC stands for Embedded Multimedia Controller, which is really not helpful, but basically it is a hard drive. So that's not going to determine whether you have a fast one or not. There are a variety of kinds of SSDs. If you're going to buy a Chromebook, you don't have to worry. Just ignore it and get whatever you like. They'll all have SSDs in them, and they'll all be roughly the same speed. It won't matter much. That is not something... Go ahead.
There was a comparison online that said using a laptop with a eMMC is like driving down a two-lane road.
Yeah. Microsoft, for instance, offers its new Surface Go with eMMC. Yeah. Well, eMMC is an SSD, but it's just a slower kind of SSD. There are many ways to connect an SSD. So eMMC is the same as the card you get in your camera. That's eMMC. So
I notice on both Amazon and on eBay, some of the ads on there for laptops, up at the top next to the picture of the laptop and where the price is, it will say 64 gigabyte SSD.
Right.
And then when you get down to the bottom, to the actual description, it will say 64 gigabyte eMMC. Now, is that misleading or not?
No, they're both solid-state drives.
Okay.
EMMC is a slower technology that includes the controller. It's basically what's in an SD card or a compact flash. It's the kind of card you put in your camera.
Okay.
So there are SSD is generic. It just means a solid-state drive. EMMC is a solid-state drive. It's just a slow kind of solid-state drive.
Okay. My other question is comparing AMD versus Intel.
Again, this is not. This is what you should just buy a Chromebook, and you won't have to worry about any of this stuff. Honestly, you'll be much happier. If you're looking at AMD versus Intel, you're looking at a Windows machine. Then you do have to start paying attention to a lot of stuff, but you don't need a Windows machine. I'm almost sure that a Chromebook will satisfy all your needs. What do you do with your laptop?
Mostly do shopping and paying bills.
Yeah.
Online, you know.
Chromebook is more secure, more reliable. If you get a good ASUS Chromebook, you'll be very happy. And the beauty of the Chromebook is that it doesn't really matter if you're using an EMMC or not. You don't have to worry about the chip. You shouldn't have. This is all from the old days when we had to worry about this stuff. We don't anymore. Yeah. We really don't anymore. Get a nice Chromebook. You'll be very happy. They're inexpensive. They're the same price as that old Lenovo netbook, a couple of hundred to $400, $500, depending on what you get. More important than EMMC versus SSD is how much memory it has, RAM storage. And I would get minimum 4, but if you can get one with 8 gigs, that's going to make more speed difference than the kind of storage. Because mostly what it's doing is operating out of RAM anyway. You're right. Avoid EMMC if you can. EMMC is a much slower choice. It's basically an SD card. You want something that's a little faster, that's actually, you know, a real solid-state drive, for want of a better term.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, the last time you might have heard my name was when you and Dickie D did a segment on a Dell DJ MP3 player that I had sent in to you.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and Dickie was fond of the Louis Prima songs.
You put Louis Prima on there, huh? I love Louis Prima.
The thing got lost when I was moving.
Oh, I'm glad you saved it. That's great.
All right, thank you, sir.
Hey, it's great. I think we worry about maybe more than we need to, because in the old days when you bought a computer, you really did have to kind of comb over the specs. I'll give you the bottom line. AMD and Intel fairly equivalent. In fact, in some respects, the new AMD Ryzen chips beat the Intel chips, but that's for specific use cases. If you don't know the difference, it doesn't going to make a difference to you. EMMC is slower than a faster kind of SSD, but again, depends a lot on your use case and so forth. If you can get something that has a regular solid state drive, and there are many designations of that, you'd be better off. I do note that the Surface Go, which is Microsoft's relatively inexpensive tablet computer, it's nice. It's 9 inches. This actually might be a good choice for you because it starts at $400 and it runs a full version of Windows 10. Although, again, I think for a lot of people, Windows is probably more than they really need. But they have two different configurations. They have the $400 configuration, which has EMMC, which is kind of surprising, a 64 gig EMMC drive. And the problem with that is it is fairly slow. I don't even think Microsoft expects to sell many of those. I think that what they do is they put that on the site as the low-cost leader so that they can say starts at $399, but truthfully, the one you're going to want is $150 more. It's $549. It has a nice 128 gig solid state drive, not an EMMC drive. It has a little bit more RAM, 8 gigs of RAM instead of 4 gigs. That's going to make a big difference in performance. So I think they put the low cost one on there just to say $499, but they don't expect anybody to buy it. In fact, I did buy the $550 version because I don't want the EMMC. So you're right in that regard. But when you're talking Chromebooks, so many other things to consider. I would look at a nice ASUS, ASUS Chromebook. They make very nice ones, aluminum, $350 to $450. I think, a really good choice. And they don't use eMMC. They use nice SSDs. But again, it's not going to make that much difference, truthfully, when it comes to actual performance. It's the RAM's going to make a difference, the processor. Let me make a recommendation for you. Let's see. I'm just looking at the... I like this Chromebook Flip that they do. It's 11.6 inches. They do have a 13.3-inch Chromebook, the C300SA. Comes in a variety of colors. Chrome is much more secure. It's got a lot of it's going to give you tons of battery life. There are a lot of good choices out there. They make some aluminum ones that are really good. I would worry more about the screen, the quality of the keyboard, and that kind of stuff than I would worry about the other. I want to find you a great Chromebook. Actually, Amazon, believe it or not, we were talking before the break about Chromebooks, has a very good selection of Chromebooks. And they will tell you what the best seller is. Maybe it's an Acer, not an Asus. Let me just... I don't know. There's some really good choices. There it is. The Acer Chromebook 14. $264, all aluminum, 14 inches, $264. And it's reliable, it's robust, it's not going to have the security issues. I just think for most people, unless, you know, you're editing photographs, and even then you can do a lot of what you want to do. Launching rocket ships, editing movies, it's a great choice. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, back to the phones. On the line, line two, Tony in Buffalo, New York. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging on. Yes, sir.
So glad to get on today. I have Verizon Fios here.
Yep.
And I'm using one of their routers, the new one, the Quantum Gateway.
You have to, don't you?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, you can use others, but you lose some of the functionality if you do. Like, you don't get the program guide.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I bought a mesh system. I'm looking at it right now. I just got it in the mail today.
Good.
It's a Tendinova.
Okay. Don't know that one, but I'm sure it's fine. So the key on this is you need the Verizon gateway because that's what's turning the fiber into Ethernet. You know, just like a cable modem or a DSL modem, you need a demodulating device that'll take whatever it's coming in and turn it into something your devices can use. But you don't need the other part that's in there, which is the router. The router is the bit that says, you know, I have more than one internet device. I know Verizon only gave you one address. That's confusing because I have 10 computers and phones and all sorts of stuff attached. The router is the thing that takes the incoming traffic, all coming to one address, and says, "Okay, you're the phone. You were having that conversation. You're the computer. You were on that website. You're the Roku box. You were on Netflix." And routes it, sends it out, figures out what goes where. Now the Verizon device does that. If you can put it in bridge mode, that would be the best. You may not be able to. I wouldn't be surprised if you can't.
That is my question. I was thinking I'm supposed to plug this into a modem, or I don't have a modem. I have the router.
Most routers would love to be the only device. They want to be doing all the routing, especially mesh routers, because that's often how they do their mesh magic. You know, they want to be in charge. But if Verizon won't let you, and it's my bet that they won't, you're going to have to figure out if you can take that Verizon gateway and put it in bridge mode. And that means logging into it with the browser, looking through the settings. It's worth a Google. I'll see if the chat room knows. But if you can take that Quantum gateway and turn it into just a dumb gateway, not a router, that'd be best.
And what if I went into the router settings and turned off the Wi-Fi radios?
Well, you want to do that is for sure do that. That
and
doesn't make it
into this
yeah, thing. But that doesn't make it not a router. So it's doing two different things. The radio is just a Wi-Fi transmitter receiver. That's separate from routing. So and what you want to turn off is routing. So definitely turn off the radio because you're going to have your own radio with the mesh. You don't want it to conflict with the mesh. Let me see.
I want this to do the routing then.
Most now doesn't have to in most cases. You're gonna, I don't know, I'm not familiar with this brand, so you're gonna have to look in their manual and say, see if it has to be the router. But I have a number of routers, the Eero and the Plume, for instance, that can live with not being the router. They can live with just being the Wi-Fi access point. They won't be able to give you all the features. For instance, you know, in both Plume and Eero's case, I pay extra for filtering and cleaning up the and so forth. I'm in a similar situation. I have an Xfinity or a Comcast business class router modem, and I can't put that in bridge mode either. So I put my Plumes on that. The Plume works just fine. It works fine as a Wi-Fi access point. It works. The mesh, most of the mesh works. There's just a few features that won't work.
Okay.
So ideally, and I'm looking, in fact, we'll put a link in the show notes to a Verizon forums post. Verizon's not going to tell you how to do this, but it looks like in this Verizon forum post, they have some things that sort of, put it in bridge mode. There's no switch, of course. This is very common. You know why ISPs don't want you to do this? If they're the router, they can throttle your bandwidth. They can see what you're doing. They get a lot more information if they're the router. They even know what sites you're going on to.
And I'm happy with the Quantum Gateway. I mean, it's fast and it gives pretty good, decent coverage, but it has, we have a small house. You know, it's only about, no basement. It's about 900 square feet.
Yeah.
And it's good for coverage, but like it has some features like a guest Wi-Fi network, and I have two Wyze cams that I want to connect to the guest network.
Yeah,
and
it drops
those connections constantly. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't drop them, but they go down to like zero. You know, the picture just freezes.
Verizon probably would prefer you use their camera.
Yeah.
Please don't use third party. So Dr. Mom in our chat room says she has the Verizon Fios router, and she says she can put hers into bridge mode, but you lose functionality like TV control over the Wi-Fi and stuff. So that's not surprising. I mean, if you make that router a dumb box, maybe you'll lose some features there too.
No, I don't care about that. I can use like the TV Guide app.
Well, you have to judge this. So first thing to figure out is how well the new mesh routers you bought will work in bridge mode. If they will, then maybe just do that.
So do I have to put the mesh router in bridge mode?
Yeah. One has to be in bridge mode. You don't really want what we call double NAT, where they're both doing it. Worst case, you can, but that's almost always suboptimal. So one of the other should be in bridge mode. You really only need one router. You should let one device do it. You don't want both devices routing. That gets crazy.
Right.
So the Eero will work in bridge mode. In fact, the Eero will detect it. Eero or the Plume, one of them will detect it automatically and say, "Oh yeah, I can't be I can't be in charge. It's okay. I'll be subservient." I think, you know, I don't know anything about the mesh router you bought, but if you can put it in bridge mode, try it that way. See how life is for you.
All right. I'll give it a shot.
Yeah. And if you could figure out how to put the Verizon in, I'll put a link to this. Did you say it's the G1100?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So I have a thread. It doesn't look easy. it looks like it's possible, maybe, sort of. I think, you know, unless you really need some of the features provided by the mesh router, just put it in bridge mode. You'll be fine. Think of it as a Wi-Fi access point only, not a router. Those are two separate functions.
Right, right. All right, Leo, thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling. Thanks for hanging on. I appreciate it. April, Panama City, Florida is next. Hi, April.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
I have
a really simple question. None of this complicated stuff that you've been doing here.
Okay.
I have listened to you, and I took the leap, and I dumped my very expensive antivirus and maintenance program
just
this week, and I put it on Defender.
Good.
But I need to know now what reasonable good program I can purchase or maybe even get free to keep my system running well, to keep my registry cleaned.
No, you don't need it.
My general maintenance.
What version of Windows are you running?
Why not?
What version of Windows are you running?
10.
Yeah, you're good. This is the whole point of not having... You don't need... I know they'll show lots of ads. Oh, your system, blah, blah, blah. You don't need any of that stuff. Windows does it all. It's fine. Even the antivirus part. Anything you put on your system becomes a potential front door for malware, for bad guys. And that's my real problem with antivirus programs is a lot of times because they hook so deep into the system, they become wonderful conduits for bad guys. And we've seen this happen with numbers of different antiviruses. So there's one that comes with Windows. Some people say, oh, it's not as good. That's fine. It does everything you need it to do. A burden is on you no matter what. No antivirus will protect you from bad behavior. Don't go to bad sites. Don't download software from people you don't know. In fact, my real advice is download as little software as possible. And you absolutely don't need any of these cleaners. Your system is designed to maintain itself. No third-party cleaner necessary, especially on Windows 10. Save your money. Your system will run better and faster and be less vulnerable, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and back to the phones we go on to line three. And Clarence in Chesapeake, Virginia, you are very patient, Clarence. Thanks for hanging on.
Oh, thank you, Leo. Got a question for you about the operating system on my Windows XP. I saw an advertisement on Facebook. A couple execs from Hewlett Packard are advertising their operating system. You just plug in the USB drive and turn it on, and all set.
So it runs off. It runs off the USB drive instead of off the internal drive.
Right. I'm thinking it's probably Linux.
Yeah. You said they were from HP.
Yeah, they were advertising on Facebook, and
I'm sure it's Linux. How much do they want for it?
I didn't open the app to find out anything about it.
I understand, and I support your desire to advance because Windows XP, as you well know, has been out of service for a couple of years now. Microsoft's not patching it. You're probably noticing some programs now refuse to run. You can't get up to date browsers on it. It's probably a good idea to get something more modern. On the other hand, an XP machine isn't going to be modern horsepower, so you have to be a little careful. You might be able to put Windows 10 on that machine and have it run fine, but Linux is often a very good choice. You don't need to get something packaged up for you, though. You can do this all yourself fairly easily. Have you ever used Linux?
No, I've heard you talk about it a few times, yeah. But I never...
So if you feel comfortable with this, well, let me give you the steps you'd need to do. You need to get... first of all, you need to make sure that hardware can boot to an external drive, a USB drive. Probably can. Almost all hardware can, but it's fairly old, so maybe not. So you know how you get into the BIOS setup on your computer? Have you seen that flash
right
up? You hit F12 or escape or delete. The keys vary, and it'll get you into that plain text screen. In there, you'll be able to change the boot order, and you want to have it look first to see if there's a boot drive on the USB port. So once you set that, then that means you can use this thing that they're selling on Facebook. I'm a little nervous about this. I don't know if HP really does sell such a thing, so I'm a little nervous about this.
I don't think if HP is doing it, they're retired execs.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, it's a clever idea, but honestly, buy a 32-gig USB drive, for $20 and download a free copy of Linux and put it on there. You can do the same thing. So that's why I was asking how much they're charging. They shouldn't charge too much for that. They probably saw this
you
as...
Got me. Yeah, you kind of reminded me of what that previous program you had was. Talking about using Linux, and
I like Linux a lot, and I think Linux has come an awful long way. You know, I have a fairly recent ThinkPad Yoga, second generation Yoga, and I thought, I wonder if Linux will run on this. I installed a version of Linux called Antergos, which is my favorite kind, and it's running flawlessly. It saw the network card, it did everything right, it just boom, it just worked. This is one pitfall with Linux, unfortunately, is your hardware, unlike Windows, which is designed to work with any possible PC out there, you know, Linux is pretty much by enthusiasts for enthusiasts, and so it may not work out of the box with everything. In particular, your internet card, your Wi-Fi card. That's the one you want to make sure. So what you do is you get a USB drive. Go to Ubuntu. That's probably a pretty good choice. It's free, ubuntu.com. They've got instructions there for downloading Linux, and then you have to put it on the USB drive, and you'll do this in Windows XP. Put it on the USB drive in such a way that it can boot up. They'll probably recommend a program like Rufus or Unit Boot In that's a free program you download, and it makes that USB drive, that little 32-gig thumb drive, bootable. Truthfully, you could probably get a 16-gig or an 8-gig. It'd be fine. Makes it bootable. Once you put Linux on there, make it bootable. It's just like that thing those former HP executives are selling. You change the boot order on your computer. You start up from that USB drive, and now you're running Linux. There's one drawback to this, though. You're running the operating system off of the USB drive. They're not very fast. Remember our caller earlier was talking about eMMC memory. That's pretty slow memory. So it's not as fast even on an XP machine as your internal drive. But what it'll give you a chance to do is see if everything works. See if you like it. See if you can use it. And then it'll have an install button on there, which you can then install it onto your XP machine and replace Windows XP with Linux, which I don't think is a bad idea. But I would only do this if you've got some time and you're willing to study and learn, because inevitably some things will crop up. It's not completely, you know, user-friendly yet. A lot better than it used to be. Do you feel comfortable doing all that?
Well, I think I feel more comfortable looking at that Acer 15.
That's what I would do. Nailed it. Get a Chromebook. By the way, that's Linux. Yeah, you'd be better off. But, you know, then you've got a laptop. You've got that nice Acer 15, which is, by the way, that's the one I was trying to remember. Not Asus, but Acer. And you've got a computer that's working. And then you can play with the XP machine and maybe put Linux on it. That would be a good choice.
Will the Chromebook run movies that I've got, my disk?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll run that just fine. It also supports Netflix and Amazon movies, all of that stuff.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot on Netflix right now.
Yeah. Netflix runs just fine on a Chromebook, yeah. It's actually, I think 90% of what people do on computers, they can do on a Chromebook. It's the higher end pro stuff like photo editing, movie editing, rocket launching, that's not great on a Chromebook. You can't do very well on a Chromebook. Although there's a lot you can do with a Chromebook, and including run Linux if you want. So they've gotten so much better. You can get Android apps, so anything you can do on Android, you can do on one of these more modern Chromebooks. That's a nice feature, too. I like the Acer 15. It's gorgeous, too. It's all aluminum. And it's not expensive.
Yeah, that sounds a lot better, and no headaches. It's going to start up when you turn it on.
Exactly.
And if I mess something up, I can just power wash it and go, you know, right back to my settings.
That's right. You can get it for $264 on Newegg. That's a pretty good deal.
Newegg, I'll write that down.
Yeah, or Amazon or Best Buy or lots of places. But Newegg, $265, that looks like the lowest price. And they have a variety of other ones as well. And there's a sale. So if you go right now, it's a Intel Pentium, 4 gigs of RAM, 32-gig flash drive, 15.6-inch touchscreen. That's pretty nice. That's pretty nice. And, you'll never have any problems with it. If you ever worry about it, they have this feature in Chrome OS called Power Wash that basically reinstalls the whole thing from scratch. And since you're tying it to your Google login, you just log in again and all your programs download, and you're right back to where you were before. It's a very nice system.
Easy peasy.
Easy peasy's the word. Nice to talk to you. Thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it, Clarence. I know people, hey, you too. People think I'm a Chromebook fanatic, and I am. I really am. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The tech guy. He's Chris Marquardt, the photo guy, as you can probably tell by the music. Chris joins us every week to talk about, I don't know, having fun with photography. I guess sometimes people might say, well, is that technology? It doesn't have to be. You have a great book on film photography, which I own and love. But nowadays, technology has a great deal to do with photography, I would say.
Yeah, it is full of tech. It is full of advances to the point where the technology kind of disappears. I mean, that's what the manufacturers have always tried. They automate everything for you. They make they expose the picture for you, so you don't have to think about the aperture and ISO and shutter speed. They will automate colors for you, what we call white balance, so that the pictures have kind of natural colors wherever you are. They will try to even automate weird things that are not even in all the cameras right now. I mean, if you look in a smartphone, the smartphone will analyze your photo before you take it, and it'll know that thing on the top is the sky and the thing on the bottom is a green meadow and the thing in the middle are people. And then it'll take care that the sky looks good and the meadow looks like a meadow, nice and juicy green. And then the skin tone of the people is right. There's an entire processor in there that does that. So the technology does a lot to allow you to kind of lean back and just point the camera somewhere and press the button and get a good photo. But if we go into the area of, let's say, mirrorless cameras and DSLRs, let's say the more advanced the photographer gets, the more they want to take control. They want to take control back over some of those systems, because the biggest problem with all these automated systems is that they don't know your intent. They can only guess what you want. I mean, for example, let's look at autofocus.
Yeah.
When you point the camera somewhere, it has to focus. It has to tune its lens and set the distance between these little lenses in there so that whatever you're pointing it at is sharp, right? And that's the norm. The lenses do autofocus. The cameras do that for you. But then there are some lenses, especially in cameras where you can swap lenses, that are manual focus, where you have to do this manually.
And it's because of you that I am stuck right now with a manual focus lens in beautiful downtown Barcelona. It's your fault.
I think you'll come back with
I'm excited.
A few very, very interesting insights into photography.
Yeah, I mean, using a modern camera that can do autofocus. In fact, it's got very good autofocus. But right. the lens I'm using is a kind of old school lens that you hand focus. I kind of like that, though, because I choose what to focus on, right?
It has pros and cons. I mean, if we look at autofocus, it has its benefits. It's usually very precise. It's usually fast enough. It's good enough in terms of focusing. And in special cases, let's say you are a wildlife photographer, you want to take pictures of birds in flight, or a sports photographer with people running at you, it can be a lot more precise than what you can do manually. Because if you look at the flagship cameras, the big models of the manufacturers, those that sports photographers would use and wildlife photographers would use, those you can fine tune how the autofocus works. So if you have a flock of birds in the air, you can tell the camera
follow that bird.
You can kind of point in the right direction, and it will always be in focus. I mean, this is amazing what these cameras can do.
Oh, it's amazing. My Sony A9 that my lovely wife got for me, it was very, very expensive. There's a button on it that says track the eye. So if you're doing model photography, you press this button, and then it doesn't matter. You can move all around, and the eyeball is always in focus, which is most of the time in portrait photography what you want. That's remarkable.
It tends to be what you want, but of course, autofocus also can have its issues because, as I said, it doesn't know what your intention is. What do you want to do? It might choose the wrong thing in the photo to focus on. It has to do some guesswork, and normally it employs algorithms where it's okay, let me try to get the middle of the shot in focus. That's usually where the action is. Let me look for contrast. Contrast is usually what the camera can focus on easily. or let me give priority to, let's say, a face, for example. That's what you just said. The eyes are important in portraits. Yeah. So the camera does face recognition. It knows that this is a face and I want to focus on the eye. The contrast detection can be a bit tricky, especially when people wear glasses, because I've seen this often. If you work with a lens that gives you a very shallow depth of field, the contrast, the focus has to be very precise. And then if someone's wearing glasses, it sometimes happens that the camera locks the focus not on the eye, but on the glasses in front of the eye.
That's not good.
And if you work with an according lens that has very shallow depth of field, you end up with a slightly out of focus eye, which will drive professional photographers up the walls. But then let's look at manual focus. Again, has some benefits, has some issues. Benefits is you can focus where you want the focus to be. There's no guesswork from the camera. You call the shots. You are the one who tells the camera, this is where you focus at. But it requires some skill. You have to practice that. It also helps if you have special type of equipment. We're talking about special focus screens, like a prism focus screen is one thing that helps very well here. Also, some lenses work better for autofocus than other lenses. Most lenses in cameras these days are what we call fly-by-wire lenses. You might have a focus ring on them, but if you turn that focus ring, it's not mechanically changing the focus. It's telling some chip that, oh, he turned the ring a bit to the left, now change the focus. So it's kind of a bit detached, you know. Those lenses can manual focus. You can use them to manual focus, but that doesn't really mean that you should, because it is more touchy. I have one of these lenses, an STM lens, which has a stepper motor in it, which, yeah, you know when the first automatic transmissions came out in cars?
Yeah.
I mean, driving those was you were very detached from the road.
That's a really good analogy, because in the early days, a human could do a better job shifting. But nowadays, a modern automatic transmission is going to do a better job.
Double clutch automatic these days? Yeah. Come on. I mean, this is just a very different beast now. But the same is with lenses. So some cameras can manual focus, but yeah, it's probably not the right thing to do, but
Now my camera has
it works for you, right?
Yeah, my camera has a bunch of features for manual focus. I'm also shooting with a Sony, this time the A7R II. It does a weird thing. If something's in focus, it highlights it. I use red, so it looks like I got sparkly red wherever stuff's in focus. It also lets me zoom in three levels of zoom, so I can get really close, focus it, and then I can take the shot and it backs out. That helps a lot. It still takes time.
And even if you use autofocus, I mean, the important thing is if the autofocus doesn't hit it, if it doesn't focus where you want it to, there will probably be ways that you can tell the camera how to do it. You can nudge it in the right direction, maybe select a different focus point or tap on
you could do
touch
the
screen
the photographer's
and tell the
pivot.
To focus.
I do this all the time. The photographer's pivot, where I use a center point focus. I press it halfway down and focuses. That means that on the item I want, but then I don't necessarily want it in the middle, so I'll do the photographer's pivot. Keep the button pushed, but reframe the picture and then take the picture. So
yeah,
that's kind of manually focusing with an automatic focus.
that is one way to do it, and that's a good trick to kind of have both worlds.
Chris,
best of both worlds.
We're out of time. Chris Marquardt, he's at discoverthetopfloor.com. He's my favorite photo guy. Inspires me every time. We'll talk pictures when I get back from my trip. You can take a look at some of my out of focus shots. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We should go back to the phones. I've got calls lined up, stacked up, all the way to Fontana. That's where Jason is on the line. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
My Long pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
So my question was, a couple years ago, I bought a Panasonic Viera 4K television. It was, at the time, you know, hottest one on the shelf. And
it wasn't a 4K unless you bought it recently. It's a plasma. Right?
No, it's 4K.
4K plasma?
Nope.
Oh. 4K LED, LCD. All right, so it wasn't that long ago you bought it, like a year or two ago.
Okay, yeah, maybe it was like, yeah, year and a half ago.
Yeah, okay.
Anyways, I'm looking at getting another 4K TV for another bedroom, and walked through Costco, saw Samsung, you know, all those other, you know, Costco ones on the shelf there. And I'm curious if the software and the hardware that's doing the 4K algorithms and all that, you know, processing inside of the TV, am I going to get with a newer Samsung the same type of quality and speed that I was used to with my Panasonic?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, it's going to be even better because, you know, technology improves over time. What you're going to get, does your Panasonic, I mean, your Viera have HDR, for instance?
It does not.
Yeah. So that's immediately going to be a very visible improvement.
Mm-hmm.
4K, normally, if you're watching 4K content, there's not a lot of processing going on. Where you do get a lot of processing on the TV is where you're watching HD or lower quality, and it has to upscale it to 4K. And that can vary dramatically from TV to TV. Is that what you're concerned about, is upscaling?
Yeah, precisely. So if I'm watching an HD program and it's upscaling it, somebody told me that the Panasonic had the rights or something from Sony for their algorithms and their processing for upscaling. And
oh, that's interesting.
Kind of getting around that, you know, that time of buying the new TV, thinking, I want to make sure that if I'm going to get one that's, you know, off the shelf there at Costco or something, that, you know, it's going to have the same processing speed and ability to upscale that I'm familiar with on the Panasonic.
That's a really interesting question. It is an important question because there isn't a huge amount of 4K content even today. So the quality of the scaling is going to be fairly important. And I have not seen a lot of reviews on this. There is a, you know, ratings.com, RTINGS.com. And of course, that has reviews that apparently does consider upscaling. And I would also refer to our friend Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guru's site, avsforum.com. One of the nice things at AVS Forum is you could ask that question and see who people like. It's funny. We used to talk about that a lot. When HD first started, I would bring this up a lot because there were very big differences between TVs. My sense is they're all pretty good now. You know, they all do a good job. I have an OLED TV from LG, 4K HDR, and I don't even notice that it's upscaling or not. The HD content looks very good. I don't pay attention to it anymore. So I would guess that it's probably, unless you go really cheap, you're probably okay. That Viera was one of the best TVs ever made. I mean, that's a really good TV. I have a Viera a plasma, that's why I asked, that I'm never getting rid of. I just love it. And it does do, you're right, an excellent job of upscaling. But I don't know. You know, this is one I'm going to have to ask Scott, our home theater guy, if he's paid attention to this. You know, and in some cases, the upscaling won't happen on the TV. In a lot of cases, it won't. What are you watching from? What's your source?
Any multiple sources.
Right.
Through, you know, the smart TV applications, or from my Roku 4K or my PlayStation 4 or everything, you know.
So, you know, this is part of the issue, is that the upscaling can happen in a variety of different places. And so it may be when you're watching your Apple TV or your Roku or whatever, it's doing the upscaling. If you're watching from a Blu-ray UHD player, it's doing the upscaling, and the TV never gets a chance. So I don't want to say one way or the other. You've kind of stumped me. Sony does do very good, as you mentioned. Sony does very good upscaling there, but you could always get a Sony UHD Blu-ray player, and that would be doing the upscaling. So I do not know. I'll ask Scott Wilkinson, and in a future episode, maybe we'll make a whole segment devoted to that. Actually, that's make a note of that, upscaling. And if you keep do you listen on a regular basis?
Just about every single Saturday.
All right. Well,
and Sunday.
Scott will be on next Saturday, and I will make a point of making that be all about upscaling and which ones are best. In fact, I'm going to send him a note so that he's prepared, because you got me unprepared. I just don't know. But it's a good question. You can always look, but it's hard to tell, you know, when you're in a store. The lighting condition's not optimum and all sorts of things. So I just don't know. So you're right. Sony probably is the best. They've spent a lot of time on all that, and I don't know about the patent situation. All right, let's go back to the phones, and Steve in Bellflower, California is next. Hi, Steve. Are you there, Steve? Hello, Steve. I wonder if... Steve gave up. He said, no, I don't want to talk. I'm scared. Sorry. Sal in Whittier, California. Hi, Sal.
Hey, good afternoon, Leo. How are you doing?
Don't be scared. I'm not going to bite. What can I do for you, Sal?
I got this question. I have an old Windows machine that's running Windows 10.
Okay.
And I want to pull all the photos and videos off and store them on a portable drive like a Seagate.
Sensible.
But when I started, I noticed that the created date is the day that I transferred the files, not the actual date of the pictures.
Yeah.
So I want to retain that. Is there a way of doing that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's really software dependent. What are you just copying?
Yes.
Okay. So.
One more thing, yeah. If I can, I want to add is I'm going to get rid of this Windows machine and buy an iMac. So I don't know if that plays any factor in it at all either.
Well, the only factor would be don't format the hard drive NTFS because it's a little harder for Macs to read NTFS. Make sure it's XFAT or FAT32, or I guess you could be FAT16. So the trick is that the copying program has to have an ability to say, use the original date, don't modify it. And Windows copy is notoriously bad. The good news is you probably should be using a program that is already on your computer. Microsoft knows how bad its copy program is and has a program on there called RoboCopy, which sounds like robot, but I think they really mean robust. And in the options for RoboCopy, you can say, don't modify the date attribute.
Okay.
So in the there's a copy flag /copy, and you could say copy all the timestamps or all the attributes or whatever it is. So don't modify on copy because you want to keep the dates. Yeah, I understand that. That date is probably the date you took the picture.
And, you know, for the kids, that's really important.
Yeah, of course you want that. Now, truthfully, most cameras will store that information also in what's called the EXIF, or extended information fields. So that data is not lost even if the file modification date is changed. But if you want to keep the file modification date, use RoboCopy. RoboCopy's better anyway because it verifies after copy. You want to make sure, especially in a case like this, that you're making a good copy. And Windows copy is just loosey-goosey, and it doesn't they can make mistakes and it just keeps on going. RoboCopy won't. So you'll have to go to the command line to use this. And when you do, get the help file so you can see all the switches. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. The Tech Guy podcast brought to you today by Qualcomm Snapdragon. You know I'm a fan of the Qualcomm Snapdragon. I always ask, is it an 845 in there? Mm-hmm. In fact, most of the new phones now, and I'm very excited to have this Qualcomm Snapdragon 845. There's a few reasons you want it. Number one, speed. No one wants to wait for data to download movies, music, content. I just downloaded a new audiobook for my trip. Woof. That's on that Note 9 with the 845. I love the Snapdragon 845 processor. It is fast. Ookla, you don't have to take my word for it. Ookla, you know the folks who do the speedtest.net, they just did a survey of 1 million real-world results from the speedtest app running on AT&T and T-Mobile phones in the second quarter, Q2 2018. They found Android phones with Snapdragon 845 from Qualcomm had up to 192% faster data speeds. Let me say that again. Snapdragon 845 from Qualcomm Technologies, 192% faster data speeds than non-Android phones with Intel modems. That's 192%. It's pretty fast. Wow. The Snapdragon 845 mobile platform has other great features, including a third generation Qualcomm Hexagon 685 DSP. That is really fast for things like VR, AR, voice integration. So, it, you know, understanding voice, camera processing. The DSP really makes a difference, makes those pictures just pop. It also has advanced vault-like security. This is kind of a must-have, the secure processing unit. It's engineered to help protect personal data. Biometrics used for authentication can be stored, for instance, in isolation, keeping it out of the hands of bad guys and other prying eyes. And the Qualcomm Snapdragon 845 is energy efficient and engineered for all-day battery life. And I love that quick charge, the up to 50% of battery charge in only 15 minutes. That's sweet, too. You're going to love it. Check it all out at qualcomm.com/twit. There's a list of phones that use the 845. All the new Android phones are using it. It's superb. Qualcomm.com/twit. Upgrade your data speeds with a brand new phone powered by Snapdragon 845. And we thank Qualcomm Snapdragon for their support for the Tech Guy podcast. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, talking computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches. We're going to go back to the phones in a second, but for the next couple of weeks, I want to do something a little different. A friend of mine, Adam Fisher, has written a book called Valley of Genius, The Uncensored History of Silicon Valley. Interviews with 200 of the most important people in Silicon Valley. And when I heard he had these tapes, I said, look, I got to play these on the radio show. They're just too interesting. This week, we're going to talk with Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari. Tell me about Nolan, Adam.
Nolan Bushnell will be remembered as one of the most important cultural figures of the century. He essentially invented the video game industry. He did the first arcade video game, the first video game where
Pong. It's the first one I ever played. I remember spending a day, a very bad day, in a bar with white Russians and Pong. I had never seen such a thing, and I played it for hours.
With a friend.
No. Well, it must have, right? You can't play it alone.
Can't play it alone. It was a social game. It was a dating game.
I'll never forget it. It was like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Al Alcorn was a work-study engineer from Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they worked it is they would work in the industry for 6 months, then they'd go back to Berkeley for 6 months, then they'd work in the industry for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And Al was on his second tranche at Ampex. Mm-hmm. He was my tech, and I needed a training project for him because computer space was pretty complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that, and we had contracted with Valley for a driving game, which would take little cars and, you know, and, you know, it was going to be a hard project.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, I'm going to pitch him this learning project, this ping pong game.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that I had a contract with General Electric or something. I don't remember because I find that people don't like training projects or dead end projects. And so it was a little fabrication. And Al basically had the thing going, I think in a week, as I remember. It might have been a week and a half.
Uh-huh.
And it was fun.
Uh-huh.
It started out not to be fun because the angle off the paddles was angle incidence, angle reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was strictly a defensive game.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to segment the paddle so that if you hit the top of the paddle, it would go up instead of just angle incidence, angle reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it fun.
Mm-hmm.
But now the game started to go too long.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to speed up the ball after so many volleys, and it was still, you could still get good enough that the game would last too long, so we then cut the paddle in half. Because in a coin-operated game, you want most of the people to lose in 3 minutes. That's just kind of the rules. And I thought to myself, maybe Valley would like this game instead of the driving game. What happened was we had the tiger by the tail.
Mm-hmm.
We had more orders than we could fill. I can remember telling Alcorn and Dabney that we were going to move production up to 100 a day, and they looked at me like I was just stark raving mad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we had to get a lot of space and various things. But I figured out how we could finance it, mm-hmm. and that was the issue.
Mm-hmm.
But understand that we had no purchasing department, no manufacturing skill. We had no procedures. We had no quality control.
Mm-hmm.
We had nothing,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so we were literally making it up as we were going along.
Mm-hmm.
We had been running the company with tricks and mirrors from a cash standpoint, even with the venture capital infusion, which I think was like $3 million or something like that. That gave us cash flow, but it was very clear that the launch of the VCS was going to consume a massive amount of capital.
Mm-hmm.
We had to build a whole big new factory. We had to, you know, not only were we going to be building these consoles, but we had to build all the cartridges and package them, and you know, it was just, we knew that it was going to be a very successful product,
mm-hmm.
but we knew that there was no way we could cash flow it mm-hmm. into the consumer marketplace. So that being the underpinnings, several of the people came and kind of kicked the tires and looked around a little bit. And then Manny Girard came from Warner and said that the chairman, Steve Ross, had been with their kids at Disneyland and played Atari games for a full afternoon and had instructed him to go see about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had some good preliminary conversations, and they said, well, why don't you come back to New York and let's see if we can negotiate a deal. And so they said, we'll send the jet. Never been on a private jet before. Climbed up, you know, into this, you know, G2, I think it was at that time. Very posh, very posh. And life was good. And they said, you know, I don't know, and you know, hope you don't mind, but we're going to have to stop in Sun Valley and pick up another guest who happened to be Clint Eastwood. So anyway, all of a sudden, you're feeling like really big shit. We get into New York, picked up by a limousine, swept off to the Waldorf Towers. Not just the Waldorf Towers. Next day, we go up, meet Steve Ross, sort of negotiate and talk about the various opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
They talk a little bit about the form of the deal, what mm-hmm. have you. And we sort of come to a handshake agreement as form and structure by probably 4 or 5 o'clock that night. They started killing off some of the projects that we were working on. What we were planning on doing is to have a game network. And the network was going to be real simple. It was, we were going to have a room full of, a closet full of computers in every area code, because in those days it was free, a local call was free, but long distance was very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And we were then going to link the closets with a T1 line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you think about that, that's fundamentally the architecture of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, and our IP stack was very, very similar to the internet IP stack. And that was killed. Now think about it, if Atari owned the internet, that would have been really cool. That would have been massively cool.
Thank you, Adam Fisher. Thank you, Nolan Bushnell, for taking some time to talk. The book is Valley of Genius, The Uncensored History of Silicon Valley. You can get a copy at valleyofgenius.com/twit, T-W-I-T. Let's take a break, and more of your calls coming up with the Tech Guy. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We continue on. So many great calls. Let's go to line 2. Steve in Bellflower. He's back. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call. I need your help.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Yes, sir.
Exactly. I've got a laptop that's about 6 or 7 years old. It's a Satellite 305. Great machine. I've had no trouble with it. Recently uninstalled Norton, and then all of my trouble started. And I ran another antiviral scanner, and it said there was a file found called window or windowsmime.csv. Quarantined it. Everything was working fine. Started rebooting over and over and over. I couldn't get it out of the reboot loop. And I finally deleted that file, and I just couldn't get the machine to come up. And then I finally started getting these errors that said MBR is corrupted or missing.
That's Oy.
Master boot record.
Okay, that's shot.
Where is that stored
That's
at?
That's not stored anywhere. It's the master boot record. It doesn't even show up in the file directory. It's the first sector of the hard drive that contains information about how to start up. And when that's damaged, your drive won't even start. Now, the good news is you can often recreate it. You can write a new master boot record. But honestly, you've had a cascade of flaws. And it all started with removing Norton. One of the things I hate Norton. Can I just say that? Yeah. One of the things Norton...
Yeah, you can say it. I hate it too.
Yeah. Of course, you're using Vista, which means you're insecure by default. So, Microsoft doesn't support it anymore and there's all sorts of flaws. But the problem with Norton is that often when it'll quarantine a virus, right? So it finds a virus, it quarantines it. Bad guys who write viruses will often either attach the virus or name the virus to a system file. And then Norton quarantines the system file and your whole system stops working. And it may be that it was continuing to work with the file in quarantine, but as soon as you deleted Norton, you deleted the quarantine, now it doesn't have a system. The whole machine is a mess. Now, I'm worried about windowsmime.csv. That sounds like a CSV file is supposed to be just plain text, but it could well be that that was one of the viruses on there because some other virus program found it. When you remove Norton, by the way, Norton's uninstall feature in the programs and features section is not good enough. You not need to go to Symantec's website and get a Norton removal tool that will go even farther. And there's a reason most antiviruses do that. It's because they don't want bad guys just to run the uninstall automatically. You know, they want you to have to take extra steps. So you do want to do that. At this point, you could write the master boot record. It wouldn't fix it. You've got a mess on your hands. You need to reinstall Windows. Can you do that?
I tried that, and it would not take it. It kept telling me the MBR is missing, and then I had to go into the settings and have it boot from the CD and then try to reinstall and... you keep getting this error. MBR is missing.
Oh, well, maybe your hard drive died then.
Well, according to the partition magic, which I ran against it to check it, it says it's good, but I don't know. I'm almost to the point where I'm ready to go buy a hard drive and start over.
So partition magic, if you ask it to, will rewrite your master boot record. That's any partition program can write a master boot record. And the reason is that master boot record contains the partition information, so it's part of the deal. However, try it. But if you're booting to the CD, the Windows install CD, and you run it, and it says I can't find the master boot record, what you should do is in the install CD, there's an options menu that lets you run a disk partitioner, repartition the drive and format it. Start from scratch.
When I did that, I tried that, and when I did that, that's when the machine crashes again. It just goes down.
Yeah, it sounds like you have a bad hard drive.
Okay, that could be it.
Yeah.
That could very well be it.
Yeah. Cause,
well, the good news is I have a spare hard drive. I can throw it in there and try it.
Easy. Easy peasy.
Gigs.
Yeah, wipe the drive and try it. Yeah. It's really time, probably. I hate to say it, but it's really time to get Windows 10 and bite the bullet. If you're running Vista on a machine, how much RAM's on that machine?
4 gigs.
Yeah, you can run Windows 10 on it.
Okay.
Or this is what I would do. You may not want to deal with this, but older machines are great candidates for Linux. Free operating system. Nowadays, awfully good as Windows. The only drawback is, Windows programs don't really run natively on it. There are ways to do it things like Wine. I really like Linux, and you can get a Linux designed for an older, slower, low-RAM machine, like L-U-B-U-N-T-U, Lubuntu. That's for low and slow machines, or Xubuntu. Those are also for older machines. They'll run more snappily than Windows, and frankly, be more secure and robust because they're up to date. They're kept up to date, and they're free. So usually with an older machine, that's what I do with them. In fact, I do it even if a machine's a few years old. I'll eliminate Windows and put Linux on it. Just put Linux on my IBM second generation Yoga. That's only a year old. Man, it runs nice though. It's it's impressive. Used to be in the old days when you used Linux, it was a real geek operating system. You had to really know what you were doing, set a lot of parameters, things wouldn't work. You'd have to tweak it and mess with it, and finally it would work. But the community around Linux has done such a great job of making it work with all existing PC hardware that even very new oddball computers like that, let's face it, the Lenovo Yoga, Lenovo's actually, any of the ThinkPads run Linux very well. It just works. Networking worked out of the box. Windows Sleep worked out of the box. Well, it's Linux Sleep now, PC Sleep. The only thing that I don't have working in is the fingerprint reader. That's fine. I can live without that. And I put a version of Linux that I'm kind of a fan of. It's a little more advanced. It's what they call a rolling distribution, which means it's kept up to date constantly, as opposed to some of the versions of Linux, which don't update as regularly but are more reliable as a result, right? They only do security patches, more like Windows and Mac. They do periodic security patches, but they don't update every time you turn it on. I use something called Antergos Linux, A-N-T-E-R-G-O-S. It's free. You can download it. It installed like a charm on this ThinkPad, and it's running beautifully. Makes me wonder why I left Windows on it so long. As you could tell, I'm not a massive Windows fan. So I think for an older computer, there's lots of good choices. It's certainly the case no one should be running Windows XP or Vista. Windows 7 is really only has a year or two left. Microsoft is pretty serious about wanting everybody to be using Windows 10 from now on. And the advantage of this is it's, Microsoft says, the last version. There's not going to be a Windows 11. All they're going to do is they're going to periodically update it. Currently, they're doing it about twice a year with features and then regular security updates every month. And once you get Windows 10 on a machine, that's it. You're done. You will never be upgrading it or installing a new version of Windows. You're going to be using Windows 10 with additional features and patches over time, and with no additional cost. In fact, once you install it on a machine, it's always a Windows 10 machine. I like that. No serial number or anything. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We go back to the calls here on line four. I've got Brown on the line from Ontario, California. Hello, Brown.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question.
All right. I'm glad you do, because otherwise we just have to sit here.
You see the fix-a stick on TV all the time.
Oh, don't do that. Oh, don't do that. Stop it. Yes. Good question.
I'm pretty sure you heard of it before.
Oh, yeah. Anytime you see anything advertised on TV, don't. Fix-It Stick is actually not a bad idea. It's a USB key that has antivirus software built into it. And so the theory is you stick it in. $10. It's cheap. You stick it in, and it will remove viruses. And there is an advantage to that. I probably shouldn't be so dismissive of the Fix-It Stick. Let me talk a little bit about why it's not a bad idea. Because a virus, as soon as it's activated, is going to do all sorts of things to protect itself, it's a good idea to boot from an external drive, in this case the Fix-It Stick. You plug it in and boot to it, and it can scan and find viruses before they're activated, right? The advantage of that is it's going to do a much better job than an antivirus that's sitting on the Windows machine itself. Let me look and see if I can find what antivirus they use, because that's going to be the real question: is it a strong antivirus or not? And I don't see what they're using. Maybe they hide this way. The premise is great, And the price is right. It's $10. So you know what? I'm going to take back what I said. A lot of the fix-it tools you see on TV are bad ideas. The Fix-Me Stick, not Fix-It Stick, Fix-Me Stick is fine. Fix-Me-Stick.com. I don't know what antivirus it uses, and I'm going to try to find that. But it's the right way to do an antivirus. Now, I should point out, if you are sophisticated, even a little bit, you can easily make a, in fact, probably everybody who has Windows should, make a USB stick that will have the requisite tools on it. There are a number of, you know, very good boot disks that will, that you can make, you know, the rescue boots and things like that, that will make these disks for you that will include an antivirus. Usually it's an open source. In fact, I bet this is one of those open source antivirus. And so, you know, if you have a USB key lying around, you can easily make one of these. I'll give you a couple of names. There's the Trinity Rescue Kit. It's a Linux distribution designed for troubleshooting. It'll fit on a USB stick. You'll boot into it. There's Hyrens Boot CD, the Ultimate Boot CD, System Rescue CD. We'll put a link in the show notes to these. Okay. The nice thing about those is you download them, you put them on a USB stick. It didn't cost you anything, especially if you have an old USB stick lying around, and it'll do everything you need to do. The unfortunate thing about the Fix-Me stick is while it's cheap to buy, $10, it's $60 a year. Now, that's what you'd pay for an antivirus, but I would submit you could probably do as good a job. And it, by the way, these Fix-It disks like Hyrens have, or the Ultimate Boot CD, have a lot of other utilities on there for troubleshooting in addition to the antivirus. So it depends how sophisticated you are. It says at the Fix-Me disk that the guy made it for his mom, and that's exactly it. It's some geek who knows how to do these things, made one, and now he says, you know, I could sell these. The come on is a little bit misleading because I saw the $9.95. That's for a 30-day trial, and then it's $60 after that. So there are a lot of great tools out there that you can do the same thing. So it's up to you. Let's see. Fix-Me stick has three leading antivirus engines on the stick: Sophos, Avira, and Kaspersky Lab. All three are very good. All right, I think this is not necessarily a bad thing, but you could make your own. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
All right. So if you're not inclined, if you're not a geek, go ahead and try it. Now, somebody's in the chat room saying, "Well, read the reviews of the Fix-Me stick," and that's probably a good idea.
Well, I'll do that next.
Yeah. Let me see. PC Magazine, it says, excellent. All right. That's good. Bootable antivirus thwarts persistent malware. Excellent handling of USB boot, both BIOS and UEFI. Remote mediation. They even have live chat support. In testing, and this is true of all antiviruses, in testing, it didn't remove all executable files and left behind thousands of non-executable traces, no real-time protection, no 24/7 support. But this is true of all antiviruses. And one of the reasons you've heard me say many times never to say, hey, I'm protected, I've got an antivirus, is that no antivirus catches all infections, especially new ones. So without real-time protection, real-time updates, you're kind of relying, you know, it does update itself every time you launch its software, so that's a good thing. Yeah, it's not a bad idea. It's better than an on-disk antivirus, but I'm, you know, I hadn't looked this up. So you're hearing me do the research in real time. It is a little slow. The PC Magazine reviewer says each of my test scans took over 2 hours. It's like any antivirus, it's not perfect, although I like the fact that it has three different antiviruses on there. That's going to give it a better chance. I'm not a huge fan of antiviruses because, as I've mentioned before, there are a few problems with them. One, they miss things. And so if you're saying, well, I'm safe, I've got an antivirus, well, you're not. They give you a false sense of security. Two, the problem with some antiviruses, all antiviruses, is in order for them to work, they've got to kind of modify your system. This is one advantage that Fix-Me Stick has. It's not modifying your system. But if you put an antivirus on your hard drive, you know, install it, sometimes that can actually be an opening to bad guys. And we've seen this happen with numerous antiviruses. They're installed deep into your operating system. And if they're not 100% secure, bad guys can use them. In fact, Kaspersky was used, apparently, by the Russian FSU to steal the National Security Agency's hacks. An NSA contractor brought home, shouldn't have done this, the NSA shouldn't have let him, but brought home the hacking tools the NSA's developed to hack our adversaries on the internet, brought him home. He was running the Kaspersky antivirus. It has a real-time update function that spotted these NSA tools and uploaded them to Russia. And because Kaspersky has a tight relationship with the Russian Secret Service, the Russian Secret Service got these NSA tools. They leaked out. Now, you're not an NSA contractor, so that's not one of the issues. But it is true that antiviruses can become a gateway into your system. One reason the Fix Me Stick would probably be preferable is it's at least it's not doing that. It's not modifying your system, I don't think. And the final reason I don't like antiviruses is because they often get in the way. And this won't have that problem either. But if you've installed it in Windows, many is the call we received. Well, I can't get on the internet or something's blocking me. And it's the security software. Security software can be sometimes over-aggressive and get in your way. So I don't use antivirus software. Windows 10 comes with Windows Defender, which is as good as it needs to be. It's not great, but it's good as it needs to be. By not installing antivirus, I don't give myself that false sense of confidence so I can practice safe computing. You know, you should always be really careful about anything you download from the internet, you click and run. Be careful about links in your email and messaging. Don't click those randomly. I think you need to be very suspicious and cynical. And see, having an antivirus might remove that sense of cynicism. Hey, I'm safe. No, you're not. And then again, it can cause issues. The Fix Me Stick does eliminate two of those problems. So you know what? If you need an antivirus, maybe that's a good way to go. Not a bad choice. Or make one of your own from one of the many boot discs. We'll put a link to some of those boot discs up on our show notes. TechGuyLabs.com. Hey, thanks for asking about that. I hadn't really paid any attention to it. Now I know. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, this actually does not look like a bad one. But read this PC Magazine review, because this thing worries me that traces of malware left behind.
Does it go out and get an updated?
It does. Every time you run it, file? It goes online and updates.
Okay, because that would be the issue.
That would be another issue, absolutely. But it says it updates every time you run it. Yeah, and the other problem is the antivirus testing is really difficult. Now, Neil's good. Neil Rubin King is good. He tested this a year ago, gave it 4 stars and an excellent review. So that's pretty good. If malware has made it impossible to install or run antivirus protection, the bootable Fix Me Stick can save you. But don't ditch your existing antivirus. Yeah, see, I think you should ditch your existing antivirus. This may be a good thing to have. I would make one of your own. But you know what? That's a lot of work, and this seems like this would save you a lot of trouble. So while I don't normally recommend stuff you see advertised on TV, this seems pretty good. Neil's an antivirus fan. He and I disagree on that. He's saying, well, you should get Bitdefender, Kaspersky, Norton, McAfee, Webroot. He says, Webroot takes up so little of your disk space and system resources, you'll be amazed. Yeah. Mm. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Last segment of the day. Last call maybe of the day. I don't know. Let's see. On the line, Ilya from Los Angeles. Hi, Ilya.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for calling.
Pleasure to speak with you. I have a couple of questions. One having to do with, what's better and more reliable and faster? Is it a VPN connection or the remote desktop?
That's a good question.
I travel a lot, and when you're abroad, sometimes you cannot access some of the websites and services back in the States. So VPN would be one solution, but would the remote desktop be a better solution?
So in this case, you know, what a VPN does is it gives you an encrypted channel to some server somewhere that lets you then go onto the public internet, but anything in between you and that server, it can't see what you're doing. It's encrypted. And so in some cases, if there's services that are blocked and you want to use them, the ISP can't see you using them. All the ISP sees is an encrypted tunnel. If you wanted to use Remote PC to do the same thing, you could, because what you would do is you'd use Remote PC to get to your home computer or your work or some other computer that's yours that you have access to, that you've put a remote access client on, and then use it on your screen and surf that way. So it's a different experience because instead of using a third party's server with a VPN, you're using your own computer. Speed, that's impossible to predict. If you have very fast internet access at home, both downstream and upstream, you have a fast computer, it might be faster because you're the only person using it. But on the other hand, if you're using a good VPN service and the server that you're connecting to is near where you're going, that might be faster. I think in general, remote PC is probably faster. But remember, there's overhead with remote PC because you're actually using a remote screen. So if you're using a remote PC program that is fast at screen drawing and all that, there's additional data being sent besides just the stuff you're doing, you're surfing to. That's a good question. Okay. I think you'd be more secure using a remote access product, because you know what's going on. Remember, though, that just because you're using a remote access product or a VPN doesn't mean that your host nation can't see what you're doing. They for sure can see you're doing something suspicious. And in some cases, they may be able to intercept and do a man-in-the-middle attack on it. So I'd be very careful. If you're going into an authoritarian country, a China, Russia, Turkey, Egypt, somewhere where you're at risk of being jailed for using a remote access product, don't. But no, it's up to you. You know what risks. Where are you going, Ilya? Are you going to Russia?
No.
Okay.
Europe.
South America. Okay. If it's not, you know, I'd be careful in Venezuela, but Brazil, you know, who cares? That's up to you. You have to keep that in mind. Remote PC may not look as suspicious, or remote access may not look as suspicious, because there's legitimate reasons. You just want to get a file on your work computer or whatever. It also may not be quite as secure. Depends. Make sure you're using and, you know, look and check into the security of that particular product, that it's not, you know, that it's totally secure. But I think, yeah, it can accomplish very much the same thing. And speed, well, you just have to try it and see. A lot of times VPNs do slow you down a lot because you're on a shared server or, in some cases, doing multiple hops, that kind of thing. So, but remember, your remote access will only be as fast as your internet access at home. And that includes not just upstream, but downstream. So, because you're a downstream client, right? So that's relevant as well. That's a great question, though. I like it. I appreciate it. Thank you, Ilya.
One more.
Sure. We're talking to Ilya, who is going to dangerous spots all over the world. Is it really dangerous where you're going, or are you just...
No, not at all. It's mostly for Netflix connection, websites, internal U.S. websites.
So Netflix might, you know, VPNs with Netflix, not always easy, you know, but it depends on the VPN. Some VPNs have direct connections. They'll be a little faster. I think maybe your remote access might be better if you have a good fast connection at home. What's your other question?
I'll try both, I guess, next.
Yeah.
My second question has to do with second factor authentication versus the security key. Google has just announced that they're going to come up and release their security key in a few weeks. And I'm wondering which is a better approach.
Oh, this is a great question.
Thank you. Suspenders.
What a great question. So Google recently said, we gave YubiKey security keys, physical security keys, to 85,000 staffers to guarantee that they were secure logging into their Google accounts. And we haven't had one phishing attempt since. It really worked. And that's why they said we're going to do our own keys. The keys they're using, YubiKeys I use as well. So it's the same kind of idea. The idea is you use a service, you log in with your password, but the first time you're doing that from a device, it's not sufficient to just log in with your password. You need to use a second factor to prove you are who you are. That's the word authentication is key here. Authentication means proving you're you. It's actually a tough computer science problem and one that needs to be solved in a lot of ways. When you go to the bank and ask for money, you have to prove you are you. Authentication is key in a lot of things. When you're buying something on Amazon, when you're trading stocks, when you're accessing your Google email, proving you are you is tough, and it's really tough over the internet. Passwords one way, but a password easily gets leaked. People, you know, don't use strong passwords. They use it multiple times, and you know, it gets leaked on one site, and then the bad guy says, oh, maybe I can use this password elsewhere. So passwords are terrible, and nobody can remember them, and that's why we always are talking about, you know, password vaults and stuff. But I highly recommend using second factor. So where does this second factor come from? Well, what you have to do is understand the factors. There are three kinds of factors. There's something you know, that's a password, right? Something you have, that's a physical key or your smartphone, or something you are, that's your fingerprint, your handprint, your retinal scan. So two-factor employs two of those. It's not two passwords, because that's both something you know. It's either something you know and something you are, or something you know and something you have. There are sites in the world, very secure sites, that require all three. You have to do a palm print, a retinal scan, authenticator key, and a password. Man, that's secure. But for most of us, two factors is plenty. So the worst way, the way you should not do, is the way many banks do it, which is a text message. So when I log into my bank, I give it the password. It says, okay, which phone number do you want us to use? We're going to send you a text message. Here's what's wrong with that. It's easy for hackers to spoof your cell phone. We've seen it happen many times. They call the phone company and say, I lost my phone. Can you send me a new SIM card? I have a new address. And unfortunately, customer service reps focus more on customer service than security. They want to make you happy. So they very often will give the hacker a new SIM card. Now the hacker is going to get those text messages. So if you can, don't use that. The next best way is software authenticators. And Google makes one, and you know about it, of course, Google Authenticator. I use one called Authy. Microsoft has one. There are lots of different ways to do this. There, authenticators can work in a variety of ways, but it's something you have because it's on your phone, right? You have your phone. You set up the authenticator when you first set up the account. It's given a secret key that's your secret key. It's actually very much like a password. But what the authenticator does is it meshes the secret key. The technical term is it hashes the secret key with the time of day and generates a six-digit number. And that changes every 30 seconds. That's pretty good. But it's not as good, and to finally answer your question, as the third method, the physical hardware key. Because, first of all, your phone, maybe the authenticator could be hacked, whatever. The hardware key, somebody has to physically have that key, put in the USB port or use Bluetooth, which is secondarily not as good. That's what Google says works the best. It's the way I recommend. I use a YubiKey, and man, I feel safe. But even two-factor authentication on a software device on your phone would be better than nothing. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T, it stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.